In this part of Focus 580, you will hear the true story of an act of eco-terrorism. Although in a larger sense, it's also about life in the Northwest and about the logging industry and its impact on the environment there. The story is all contained in a book that's titled The Golden Spruce, and the subtitle is A True Story of Myth, Madness, and Greed. And our guest this morning is John Valiant. He's the author of the book. It's published by W.W. Norton. And the book tells the story of the events that took place in one January night in 1997, when a man named Grant Hadwin, who had been a logger turned environmental activist, cut down one of what our guest says is perhaps one of the strangest and most beautiful trees in the world. It was a 300-year-old Sitka spruce that was covered with golden needles. It was a truly shocking act that, in the mind of the man who carried it out, was calculated to draw attention to clear-cutting in the Northwest. However, it made just about everyone, no matter what their concerns were, angry. It alienated environmentalists. It also alienated local loggers who had protected the tree because of its beauty, and it infuriated the native people who lived in the area who considered the tree sacred. All of this story contained in the book, and we'll talk about it here in this part of Focus 580 with John Valiant, our guest. He's written for a number of magazines, The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Outside, National Geographic, Adventure, Men's Journal, and others. He makes his home now in Vancouver, B.C. He's joining us by telephone. He's now spending some time traveling around talking about the book, and I believe that he is in Boulder today. Questions are welcome as we move through this hour. 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you have questions, you can certainly call us. Mr. Valiant, hello. Oh, there we got you. Hello.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Doing wonderfully.
Good, good. I appreciate you spending some time talking with us. Well, apparently this tree was, at least in the region, was quite famous. People would travel from all over to see it. It was a tourist attraction. And I guess the story that the way that you got onto the story was that you had moved to this area and had a book that mentioned the tree, which happened to be a little out of date. And you went there looking for it. And when you got there, you asked around, said, well, where is this tree? And someone said, well, it was cut down. And your immediate reaction was, what do you mean it was cut down? Who? Why? What? And then, of course, the search for answers to those questions ultimately led you to investigate the story. You wrote a piece for the New Yorker and then also now the book. So this, it sounds as, it must have been a shocking thing when you went there expecting to see this famous tree and someone said to you it had been cut down.
It was really startling because I could see, you know, the notion of a golden spruce. I mean, it was a botanical freak, essentially unique in the world. And you think of such things as being kind of inviolable. Like everyone in the islands had agreed that this is one tree that should be saved, even though countless others have been clear cut. And so to come and find that one gone, even as someone who had never seen it before, I just had the sense of, well, something has gone terribly wrong here.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds as if when you read people's description of the tree, it must have been extraordinary because people say, I think someone said they used to call it the ooh-ah tree because when people saw it, that's what they did. They were just so struck by it, they just said, whoa, look at that.
That's right. I mean, you've got to imagine, first of all, trees that could be, 150, 250 feet high, lots of cloud cover, lots of shade. It's sort of a dark, to some a gloomy place. And in the midst of this is this gleaming golden beacon, and it's alive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so bizarre. It's very otherworldly. It really was a kind of unicorn of the forest.
And this, apparently what happened was this was just a chance mutation. The tree was not making the normal amount of chlorophyll, and that's why it had this golden color, and that somehow, just as a matter of chance, it found itself in the place where conditions were right for it to survive, because otherwise in other conditions that tree wouldn't have survived, and certainly it wouldn't have been standing there for 300 years.
That's right. This defect, which is called chlorosis, can be caused by many different things, but it's generally fatal because, you know, when a tree isn't producing chlorophyll, it's not photosynthesizing. So it would be like you or me having lungs that couldn't process oxygen. And yet, there we are out running a marathon. And if you think, you know, the wild is not a forgiving place, and here's a tree with this enormous deficiency still able to compete with enormous healthy trees all around it and grow to be one of the tallest and broadest among them. And so it's a botanical mystery, among others.
The thing given that just that little bit of description and given how people felt about this tree, why anyone would go out and cut it down, it's pretty difficult to understand. And even more so when you look at the motivation of the person who was very concerned about preservation of forest, who wanted to do something dramatic to call attention to clear cutting, that it's still I can't quite wrap my head around the idea that somebody with that sort of mindset would do what he did. Because in and of itself was a grossly destructive act. I mean, what would prompt anybody to do such a thing?
Your take on the situation is pretty much identical to just about everyone else's. And Hadwin was a hard guy to find. Grant Hadwin, the man who cut it down, was a hard person to find information on. But I really dug after it, and I got it. And what I found was a man who was a third-generation British Columbian. Both sets of grandparents had come out as homesteaders and prospered in part due to the timber industry. He had embraced the timber industry himself wholeheartedly. He'd apprenticed to his uncle, who was one of the old-time loggers. He emulated his ways. He went up into the North Country himself, into the mountains, and became an expert at logging road layout. So his job was to go into virgin wilderness and figure out the best way to get trucks in and logs out. And he was very good at this, and he, you know, staked his claim up there, built a beautiful log house all himself, an enormous river rock chimney and everything. And what had been a front row seat to virgin wilderness became a front row seat to some of the biggest clear cuts in the province. And he had aided and abetted that. And he had a kind of an awakening, a little bit like Russell Crowe's character in The Insider, where here you are, very competent, very gifted in this particular field, and yet there are serious moral and ethical considerations that need to be taken into account. And he really struggled with that, and he began using his reports as a vehicle for critiques of logging methods. And so he was sending these back to his superiors, and his superiors were not interested in this. They were interested in his stamina, which was formidable. He was an unbelievably tough man, just born to move in the bush, and he was very competent at figuring out how to get heavy equipment into incredibly remote, difficult areas. So he had this rare skill set, and yet he began using it, trying to use it as a way to affect positive change in a more moderate approach to the forest, and he was quickly marginalized. And as he became marginalized, he also became radicalized.
And I suppose there is a question. You're one in reading the story is invited to ask questions about the state of his psychological health.
Yeah.
And whether or not this is something that a person in their right mind would contemplate doing.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know what I think, though? In a sense, Hadwin was in a schizophrenic situation. And I feel it's one that many of us live in terms of how do you balance your needs for natural resources with your wish for a healthy environment. And people in the logging industry, in extractive industries, are really on the cutting edge of that question. You know, most of us are much more insulated from it. And so here was a guy who got recognition and status from his work in the bush and yet loved it in its intact state and was trying to find a middle way and was continually unsuccessful. And I have a lot of information about him, and he tried for decades to find a way to make it work. And at the same time, I think there was also a neurochemical time bomb ticking in there. And he did become paranoid. He became increasingly hostile toward the timber industry because he was unable to have any effect. And I think a lot of people, when they become disempowered, become radicalized. And we see it. You know, we see this around the globe now. And so his final, his last act, if you will, to cut this tree down was really 30 years in the making. And what he saw, and I think it's really important for us to see what he saw when he saw that tree. The golden spruce stood on an enormous timber lease, okay, that was owned, managed by the largest timber company in the province, which has actually now been taken over by Weyerhaeuser. But at the time, it was owned by managed by McMillan Bloedel. And so what he saw, here's the one tree that McMillan Bloedel sees worthy of preservation. And all the others, it's cutting down and shipping south on barges. And the trail into the golden spruce was built and managed by McMillan Bloedel. And so what he saw was a kind of company mascot. He didn't understand that the tree was seen as a human being who'd been transformed by the Haida Nation who lived out there. He didn't understand that it was actually much beloved by the local loggers. He saw it as a symbol of the timber company, and his feeling was, if this is the only tree you care about, if this is the only tree you care enough to save, I'm going to cut it down so you can see how I feel and how so many other people feel about all the healthy trees that you're mowing down without a thought.
Yeah.
That this is his logic, not mine, but that's what he was feeling, and this is after 30 years of essentially wrestling with himself and with the timber industry.
Yeah. Well, it is possible to, and it is possible, I think, to enter into his logic without approving it, without saying I would do this, without saying that this was a good thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it is possible to, and that's what I think that you do and you try to do with the book, is get into his head a little bit to see what would prompt someone to do what he
did. Exactly. And you know, I feel quite comfortable in saying that he was not in his right mind when he did it. You know, he was so kind of overly focused and over-obsessed. And, you know, even just to get to the tree, which lay on the farthest side of the archipelago's largest river, the Yacoon, you know, he crossed it in the middle of winter. He swam across this river, as you said, you know, towing a chainsaw behind him in pitch darkness in midwinter, you know, cut through this tree in the middle of winter in the dark. You know, it's such an extreme thing to do. And it's just hard to imagine anybody doing it, anyone having the, you know, the passion or the wherewithal or even the skill or the obsession to do such a thing. And yet, even within the islands, I spoke to people, Haida and also members of the logging community, and some of them, they didn't approve of what he'd done, but they sympathized. They totally understood his frustration.
Mm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, John Valiant, his book is titled The Golden Spruce, The True Story of Myth, Madness, and Greed. It tells the story that we have just sketched out a little bit here. It's published by W.W. Norton. It's out now in the bookstores if you'd like to read it. John has written for many different magazines, including The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Outside, National Geographic. And if you're interested in being a part of here, the conversation, you want to call, you can do that. 333-9455, toll free. 800-222-9455. Grant Hadwin very clearly admitted what he'd done. He was not shy about it. In fact, he wanted people to know what he had done and why he had done it, because he was trying to make this point. So it was clear he was the one who had done it. What was the initial sort of reaction of people? You said that indeed there might be people who could say, I don't approve of what he did, but I understand what was in his mind. But there must have been initially great shock, anger, hostility. I'm sure there are people who would have liked to gone out and string him up.
That you're absolutely right. What Hadwin did after he had cut through the tree, leaving it so unstable that it would blow down in the next storm, is he sent a fax, and he sent it to McMillan Bloedel, to the RCMP, to the police, to the Vancouver Sun, the province's biggest newspaper, to Greenpeace, to the Haida Nation, and he said, this is who I am, this is what I've done, and this is why I've done it. So he was, as you say, easy to find. He wasn't hiding from anybody. The reaction when the tree came down was one of disbelief, because the tree was really seen as vulnerable as the other trees in the islands were to clear cutting. That tree was seen as inviolable. And I think people's reaction wasn't that different from the way people felt when the Twin Towers came down. It's just they couldn't process it. And this tree was such a symbol of the islands, and it really was a part of the community more than people realized. But it was a place that people went. It was a point of pride. It was something that set them and their islands apart from the rest of the world because of its uniqueness. And so people were weeping. There, one person described it to me, trying to explain how someone who wasn't Haida might understand. He said, it was like someone had done a drive-by shooting on the Little Prince.
Yeah.
And that really brought it home to me. And at the same time, there was this amazing outpouring that manifested in the form of a funeral. And so near in the forest, again, wintertime, it's snowing and raining out there. They built a stage in the forest. They put out speakers, microphones. Hundreds of people came, members of the Haida community, chiefs, elders, members of the Christian community, the ministers and priests. The police were there. McMillan Bloedel representatives were there. Members of the white logging and fishing community were there. There was this tremendous outpouring. And I think in that moment, people realized how much they had in common to lose. And at the same time, along with grief and this, and actually an amazing amount of forgiveness and kind of a gentle sort of pitying attitude toward Hadwin, there was also murderous hostility.
Yeah. Well, the Haida, as you mentioned, the Haida considered the tree sacred, and in their oral tradition, they actually had the story that the tree had been a person.
That's right.
Turned into the tree. And so for them, it was not just cutting down a tree. For them, it virtually was an act of murder.
That's right. No, they saw, and that's why there was a funeral for the tree, which I think is, a ceremony unprecedented in North America. I mean, it was really quite unique. And so there was this a deep and profound sense of loss, and also the notion that it was a kind of terrorism, if you will, that, the islands had been insulated from, and that really many of us have been insulated from. And this happened before 9/11, of course, and it was really devastating, the sense that there's no place is safe. And I think it made people feel a lot more vulnerable, but it also bonded people at the same time.
Well, I wonder particularly for people who worked in the logging industry, as you said, that to them, the tree was something special that they wanted to see preserved. And there was this little island of trees that they kept that surrounded this tree. To them, when it happened, did those kinds of people, the people who were not just running the company, but the ones who went out and actually cut down the trees, would they afterwards had said, I get it. I mean, I really do get it.
Get it in terms of Hadwin's feelings?
Yes. And would they have been able to share in those feelings? Would they have been able to say, maybe this guy's right? I mean, maybe we cut down too many trees. Maybe we did it in the wrong way. Maybe they would say, well, yes, we were doing something. It benefited us personally. It gave us jobs. It paid to put a roof over our kids' head. It was good for the local economy,
yeah,
and so forth. And yet at the same time, they would have said, but really?
Well, one guy put it really well. This is a 70-year-old logger. He'd been through it. He'd seen kind of everything there was to see in the industry. And I asked him, he was very critical. He's very environmentally aware, very critical of the industry. And I said, well, how do you stay within it with those feelings? And he said, you don't think about it, because if you do think about it, it's going to make you go crazy. And I think if you talk to most loggers in an unguarded moment, they are keenly aware that, the cutting at the rate that they're going isn't going to last, particularly with the old growth, that in a sense their jobs are finite, and many of them are sort of racing to the finish line. And so there's this sense, but at the same time they're caught, as really all of us are. How many of us would quit our jobs, or how many of us change our way of living if we knew it was destructive to the environment? We all drive, so many of us drive solo to work in cars. We know we're fouling our air, but we're caught in this system. And it's very easy to criticize loggers from afar, but they're really no different from us. And so that it presents a very interesting and difficult dilemma. And that's one thing that really drew me to the story, is I felt that the conflict that Hadwin had and the seeming contradictions of loggers who are connoisseurs of old growth and love the forest and yet are cutting it down, I felt like that embodies so much of the conflict that we as a nation, as a continent, as a species are living with. And how do we reconcile that? And it's really a dilemma. And it's there's a lot of, it's very easy, I think, to be, kind of hypocritical and a lot of, it's tempting to kind of rag on the logging industry, but at the same time, that a lot of that wood is being consumed by us, and wood is all around us, and it's that tension between what we need and what we take, and how we take it, and how we reconcile that. And that's really what Hadwin, I think, got ground up by.
I have a caller here to bring in to our conversation. We'll do that. He is a nearby community here, Belgium. That's line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I do understand the problem, and there are ways to deal with it. You know, we do keep digging away at the Tongass National Forest up there, which is very much like your beloved BC.
Yeah.
But we can go into forest and pick out trees better than we do. We don't have to clear cut. But unfortunately, clear cutting is the only profitable way of doing it.
That's right.
And we do support timber industries with a lot of subsidies, which is totally foolish, too.
Yeah.
But to get around to the question I was going to ask, this travesty happened in the middle of the winter. And were there any abilities to clone this tree on to possibly try to start anew?
Well, first of all, I really agree with the first points you were making. And your second question is wonderful because there were, of all the times that Hadwin could have cut the tree down, there was about a six-week window when the tree could have fallen and had cuttings taken that could have been cloned and propagated. And that window was January when the trees are dormant. And trees behave much like we do. Our chances of survival are much greater when we fall into frozen, if we drown or fall into very cold water, we're likely to live longer than if we fall into a swimming pool in the summer. And likewise, and the pieces, the limbs of branches of trees are preserved the same way human limbs are. They're put on ice and shipped, you know, to a place where they can be reconnected to a living tissue. And that's exactly what was done with the golden spruce. So when the tree fell in January, it was dormant. It was very wet. So it didn't dry out instantly. So they were able to quickly get cuttings, send them down to a nursery on Vancouver Island about 500 miles south, and graft them onto other rootstock.
So there's a possibility for this to come along.
Exactly. It takes a long time to figure out. It takes years to figure out if these cuttings will actually be viable. But they have proven to be thus far. It's been 8 years, and many of them are still alive. Some of them have been transplanted. And what is, you know, quite wonderful, too, is that attempts were made to propagate this tree since the 1960s. And because it was so strange, and even the timber company wanted to have it as sort of a trophy in their own arboretum near their company offices down south. So they hired a grafting expert, a geneticist, a guy who'd come in from Hungary, and he attempted to graft the tree, and it was very, very difficult to graft, and people didn't understand grafting as well 40 years ago, and there was of conifers, and there was a lot of mortality. But among these grafts, there were some that have escaped, if you will, and taken on a very surprising life in the world, and that no one in Canada was aware of. And in the course of researching this story, I found out about them, and that, you know, is a, you know, one of a couple of different, you know, very positive endings that emerge at the end of the book, and I don't want to give it away here, but it's suffice to say that the tree is manifesting itself in some wonderful and surprising ways.
That's very fortunate. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. Well, again, if you want to read the story, the book is The Golden Spruce. It's newly out, published by Norton, by our guest John Valiant. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. To go back and pick up the story of Grant Hadwin, as you explained what he did and the fact that he admitted that he had done this because he was trying to make a point, so he wasn't shy about it. He said, yes, I did it, and admitted to it. He was charged with those things he could be charged with, and I think they just were sort of on the level of malicious damage to property and illegal logging and so forth. Certainly not murder, even though the Haida might have supported something like that. He was charged, and he was due to go to trial, and he disappeared.
That's right. Yeah, he was charged with a felony, or the equivalent of a felony in American law, and he was released on his own recognizance. He was seen as a flight risk, but they had no justifiable grounds for incarcerating him. He was released on bail. Said he would go to court. His court date was in the islands, again 50 miles offshore in the community of Masset, which is it's actually a segregated community. Half of it is a native reserve, and half of it is a predominantly white logging and fishing community. And he was ordered to appear out there. And Hadwin, already, you know, rumors had been circulating about, you know, things that people wanted to do to him. You know, people were talking about lynching him and this and that. So how he would get out to court safely was a question. He didn't trust the police. You know, he was rather paranoid. He'd had, you know, some negative experiences with the police in the past. And he was a guy, again, that we have to remember, was used to moving alone through the wilderness. He was very, very comfortable being his own boss, and so he decided that he would kayak to his court date across Heckett Strait, which is an extraordinarily dangerous body of water. And I should add in here that Hadwin did actually issue an apology to the Haida for cutting the tree down when he found out about the story. And obviously, it was way too little, way too late, but the sense was, even among the Haida leadership, that he wouldn't have cut this tree down if he had known the story.
So, and he beforehand, he didn't know.
He was not aware of it beforehand. Mm. No, what he saw was a symbol of McMillan Bloedel, the timber industry, the timber company. So he purchased a kayak. He outfits himself very well. He paddles off with 5 days to make his court date. He paddles off directly into a storm. And we've got 30, 40-knot winds, 10-foot breaking waves, pitch darkness. It's a very, very remote and rugged coast up there. He spends all night in this storm, and he survives it. And he paddles back, having made very little headway, not surprisingly, goes ashore, buys some neoprene gloves because he'd gotten a little chilly after being in what's the equivalent of 0 degrees Fahrenheit with the wind chill for 10-hour stretch. He paddles off again. He's seen the next day 25 miles north, paddling again in 30-knot winds, doing just fine about a mile offshore. And it's not clear whether he's headed for Alaska or if he might be island hopping over to Masset, which is the northernmost community. So either way, it was plausible for him to be where he was when he was seen. After that day, he was never seen again. Hundreds of people were waiting at the courthouse 4 days later, fully expecting him to show up. They'd imported a scanner, a weapon scanner for the courthouse. Everybody who was entering the courthouse was being scanned, which is, you know, highly unusual for court proceedings in the Queen Charlotte Islands, Haida Gwaii. Mm. Obviously, people waited. Nobody showed up. Everybody assumed that he'd run or been killed or drowned. There was really no consensus on what had happened to him. 4 months later, on an uninhabited island in Alaska, the wreck of a kayak was found. And it was quickly determined from serial numbers and names on the gear that was associated with it that it belonged to Grant Hadwin. And the peculiar thing about this wreck, though, was that it occurred on a very exposed beach, big boulders, very large logs bouncing across it with every tide cycle, and yet the gear, despite being ostensibly there for 4 months, was in near perfect condition. And I've seen photographs of this material. The life jacket looked like it came out of the showroom. The sleeping bag just needed a good wash. The zipper worked, no stains, no fading, no tears. All the gear was like this. And it led the man who found it, who was a marine biologist and a kind of a veteran beachcomber, if you will. I asked him, I said, how long do you think that wreck had been there? And he was, you know, this is the end of storm season, okay? So it's a very violent time on the coast. And he said, well, to me, it looked like the wreck was about 2 to 4 weeks old. And that leaves a 3 to 4 month gap in Hadwin's whereabouts. And it led the police, a homicide detective from Ketchikan, Alaska, and his counterpart from Prince Rupert, British Columbia, to speculate that he might have staged the wreck, that he might have, just pushed the kayak off the beach and let it wreck where it would and disappear into the forest, which is the place he was most comfortable.
And given what's known about him, his survival skills, the idea that he could have done that and survived is actually plausible.
It is. I mean, he was a preternaturally tough man. You know, I spoke with many, many of his colleagues, and, you know, people talked about, you know, as a younger man, he actually quit drinking cold turkey when he married. He had a wife and 3 children. But as a younger man, he, you know, lived a wild, you know, logger's life, and he was known to pass out in snowbanks after a vigorous night at the bar, and he would stay there all night. He'd wake up in the morning and shake himself off, and it got to the point where there was a joke in the village where he lived, Goldbridge, look, that snowbank is moving.
Must be Grant.
Must be Grant. and he taunted grizzly bears. He just had enormous confidence in himself. And the thing is, his actions bore this out. And you know, while a lot of people would say, well, he probably drowned, I spoke to people who knew him, and they just said he was too competent. He wasn't the kind of guy who made mistakes. And, you know, there are lots of very gifted athletes and sailors and all kinds of people who are very talented and still run afoul of forces greater than they are. But nonetheless, it gives me pause, when I speculate on what happened to him.
Do you think, as people think about it, particularly people who knew him, is there a part of them that likes the idea that he might still be alive?
I think you know, there's a lot of lore on the Northwest Coast. It's a very wild place. It's a very mysterious place. It's still the frontier. You know, an age that ended centuries ago for many of us is still alive there. You know, there are still Indians. There are still trappers. There are still hunters. There are still renegades. The forest is so big. The countryside is so big. I mean, to give you an idea, British Columbia could absorb California, Washington, Oregon, and most of New England with room left over. So it's just it's an absolutely vast country. And then Alaska, you know, is right hard by. So there's lots of people who are hiding in the bush. Hmm. And everybody knows that and sort of accepts that.
Let's talk with somebody else here who's calling in McLean County, not too far away, on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Just a couple things real quickly. Number one, your story reminded me, last week I was in my garden, and I saw a beetle, like a ladybug size, and its wings were golden. I looked at it, and I thought, maybe it's just the light shining. Looked at it again, and then it flew away, and I looked and looked and looked, couldn't find it. I have never seen anything like that before, never heard of one. So anyway, that story, your story just made me...
Oh, lucky you.
Yeah, and I don't even, I mean, I need to get hold of an entomologist and see, or you know, somebody who does, works with beetles, mm-hmm. to see if they even exist or just my imagination. But the other thing is that something you brought up, and well, I can call myself an environmentalist, and I don't do a very good job of it, but the point of how to balance, you know, I live in a small town, and wherever I go, I have to drive.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And I have a car that's fairly decent, you know, but I don't want to go to something so small that it'll be unsafe on a highway. But then I recycle every single thing I absolutely can.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, where do I find a balance? How do I find a balance so that I'm not destroying the environment? Because, I mean, the thing about Alaska right now with the energy policy drives me crazy.
Yes.
Because,
yep.
I mean, I know that, I mean, if they know that there's not enough oil there, why even bother?
Exactly.
Because what they're going to destroy will never, ever be able to be restored for the amount of gas they're going to get or the oil they're going to get out of that. But if you have any thoughts on that as you talk, I'd really appreciate that.
Boy, it's, you know, you really put your finger on it. And I think that's one reason I think a lot of people feel, you know, frustrated or fatalistic or a bit helpless in the face of it. And because it does come down in many ways to politics and big business.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and it's very hard for individuals like you and me to affect policy. And I think in this current political climate, it's even harder.
Right.
You know, we've really taken a swing, toward the direction of industry rules.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, industry is a fact of life, and it's part of what makes the world go round, but there's no reason that industry can't have a conscience and can't have a more cooperative relationship with the planet that gives us everything. I mean, that's the thing that I think is easy to forget, you know, is that it gives us everything. You know, it enables us to realize all our dreams, mm-hmm. and including industrial dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, you know, a part of being a human being, you know, at this point in history. And, you know, how to affect policy. You know, I do think that you can have both. You know, I think you can drill for oil, and I think you can have a car, and I think you can also do it in a way that is more conscious. And I think, and that's, you know, I think that to me is sort of the key word here is consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, is the consciousness going to be focused on how can I benefit my friends in the oil business and keep stock prices up or whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
Or how can we, you know, are we going to be conscious of having a long-term relationship with this incredibly rich place that we live? I mean, we're extraordinarily lucky to live on this continent because it's also very forgiving, you know, much more forgiving than, you know, the Middle East was once heavily forested.
Mm-hmm.
They logged it off, and that was that. It's mm-hmm. finished, you know. And in the book, I talk about that. I'm really sort of trying to show this is nothing new that's happening now.
Right.
This is a 6,000, 8,000-year-old scenario that mm-hmm. continues to play out.
Right. Yeah, because I was born in India, and I know that the desert in India is growing very, very rapidly because of overpopulation and therefore overuse of the land.
That's right.
And it's, I mean, I could see the whole half the country turn into desert, you know, in the future. And for there, I mean, again, it's a poverty thing, and then, I mean, we can get into major politics here, international politics. But yeah, but it is international politics. My temptation someday is take a container of yogurt and put it in front of a CEO or the board and say, watch this until it spoils. And what it is the bacteria actually killing itself eventually because they don't have any more resources.
Wow.
I mean, that's exactly what we do to our Earth.
Nice.
If we don't take care of it, we're going to be the bacteria, the good bacteria that turns into major destruction. But I don't think I'm going to go there. Anyway, well, thank you so much. And your story is absolutely fascinating. I was supposed to go somewhere, and I'm still sitting here listening to you.
Oh,
I'm
really honored, and I thank you for calling.
And I
sympathize, and I think you're really on that yogurt image is very potent and apt, I think.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. Well, we would welcome others. We have about 15 minutes left talking with John Valiant about his book, The Golden Spruce, A True Story of Myth, Madness, and Greed. That's the subtitle. It's published by W.W. Norton. If you'd like to read it, you can head out to the bookstore and look for it. Questions are also welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I think, too, that you, with the book that you're trying to convey some understanding for, maybe appreciate for the life of the loggers who do this kind of work, extremely difficult, extremely dangerous. And I like the metaphor that you chose because you said, and the more you think about it, particularly how big these trees are, you said it's kind of like whaling on the land.
Yeah. Yeah. These, I mean, it's hard for us to imagine, but these many of these trees growing on the West Coast, they're the size of jumbo jets. That's how much they weigh. You know, they weigh, 400,000 pounds. And when they hit the ground, it shakes the earth. It echoes off the mountains. It's very different than felling a tree back east here or even, in the southwest in Colorado where I am. I mean, they're absolutely enormous entities. And the men who do this, it's mostly men. I've never met a woman faller, actually, though I'm sure they exist somewhere, tree faller. They take enormous risks. And to this day, logging remains the most dangerous land-based job in North America. And, you think of firemen and policemen and all that. Well, it's nothing compared to logging. There's a very high mortality rate, a terrible injury rate. And in terms of per capita accidents, the only more dangerous job is bush flying.
Hmm.
So, it gives you an idea, and there are many, many more people employed in the timber industry. And so these tiny little logging communities that we see as sort of insular and closed-minded, they're also these reservoirs of enormous pain and suffering that they suffer alone and by themselves. And people don't, so many of us, especially if you're kind of environmentally minded, we have loggers have really gotten, quite a bum rap in the past 15 years. And yet at the same time, they're living out a reality that really all of us participate in, except they do it, in a more exaggerated form because they're the ones actually extracting the resources, but they do so at enormous personal cost. And there's that I was really struck by that, and there's a lot of bravery, a lot of skill, and it's such an important piece of our history. And because it takes place in the deep forest, we really don't see it. It's kind of like fishermen; they're off our radar, they're out there somewhere, and we benefit from their labors, but we don't see what they do, and or the risks that they must take.
Another part of big part of this, in addition to this sort of basic story about the man and the tree that you are trying to, I think, tell people about is something about the history of the Haida, mm-hmm. the native people in this region.
Yeah. The Haida, they're a legendary tribe, even among North Coast tribes. They lived, they're the most remote coastal tribe because their domain was the Haida Gwaii Archipelago, which is 50 miles offshore. So they had to become extraordinary mariners because anything they wanted, to trade or mainland based items, they had to cross 50 miles of very dangerous water to get there. And the Northwest Coast culture had a lot of similarities to European culture. Particularly in the 18th century, they took slaves. They had noble classes. Art was a high priority. The accumulation of objects, very different from the Plains Indians, for example, who traveled very light. These folks had canoes that could carry, that might be 80 feet long. They could carry 10 tons of gear. They had huge boxes, bentwood boxes made from huge slabs of bent cedar wood that could, hold an entire human being. So they were very materialistic, very status conscious, extremely warlike. It was a very violent and very commercially active place. And when the otter traders came in the late 18th century, following on the heels of Captain Cook, who first landed on Vancouver Island, everything went crazy because the Chinese were buying otter skins, and they paid fabulous sums for them. And so everybody, the Haida, the other tribes on the coast, the European traders, it was really like the drug trade or a gold frenzy. I mean, the place went crazy. And this is before Lewis and Clark ever got out there. 20 years before they got there, the Haida had already captured some European ships. They had forts armed with cannon. Everybody was heavily armed. There was, you know, gunfire, cannon fire, horrible massacres. It was a very, very volatile, explosive place. Mm. And people were making money hand over fist, and it destabilized everything. And very quickly, the otter trade was exhausted, you know, through the collaborative efforts of the North Coast Indians and the Europeans. They both, you know, they were both making money hand over fist. They nearly essentially extirpated the otter from its range, and it was the timber industry that filled the gap and followed. But along with that came smallpox, and it wiped out 95% of the coastal Indian population in the space of about 40 years. So, I mean, imagine, think of your own community. If you lost 95%, you know, there'd be one kid walking out of each classroom. There'd be one person in the bar. There'd be one person in your office, or maybe two. And, you know, imagine just the psychic damage that did. And somehow, you know, the Haida have actually pulled themselves back together. And there's this amazing resurgence going on now. And very, very potent ceremonies, a lot of political power. It's a tremendous reclamation. You know, very, very, very hopeful in many ways.
Mm. Going back to the original story that we sketched out at the beginning about the man who cut down the tree and why, and his great concern about the loss of virgin forest in this part of the world leads one to wonder, just is that continuing? To what extent that's continuing? Is anybody making an attempt to stop it? And do we see the point where we will get down to maybe we'll have a few acres, tens or maybe even hundreds of acres left that someone will manage to preserve as a preserve, and then we'll go there and say, this is what it used to be like, and then you could take people out to where the clear-cutting had been, and you could see the kind of devastation of the environment there, and you can see, this is what it is, and we'll take you over to the park, and we'll show you what it used to be, and that's and we'll say that, and that's all there is left.
Yeah. You know, a lot of it is determined by the governments we choose. And I spoke to a heavy-duty, high-ranking forest manager, you know, worked for Weyerhaeuser, the biggest timber company in the world, and he said, you know what, if you want to preserve it, preserve it. Just tell me what you want to save and let me know what I can cut, and let me focus on that. And so, you know, he wasn't at all, you know, there shouldn't be any parks. You know, I think there's a lot of common sense out there. But at the same time, if the gate is opened to industry, and it's the governments who open the gates, if the gate is opened, people are going to go there because there's money to be made. And there's this sense, and it's the same sense that the Haida would have had as they saw their otters disappearing in 1810. If I don't do it, somebody else will. And that's, you know, that's kind of that fearfulness. And that short-sightedness is just part of, you know, where our species is right now. Mm. And, you know, for us to evolve past that, you know, there are people trying to think about that. But I do think there comes a point when the government needs to step in and say, look, this is we're gonna hold on to this, or else the people need to step in. And that's what's happened in the Queen Charlotte Islands, Haida Gwaii, is that since that tree was cut down, an extraordinary alliance has formed between the white logging community and the Haida. And this is unprecedented because there have been logging and forestry battles up there for 30 years, and it's usually the white loggers side with the industry and the Haida and the environmentalists are on the other side. Well, the environmentalists are sort of out of the equation now, and it's the people who live in the islands who have the most to lose who are taking a stand, and they actually, white loggers and the Haida, who are also loggers, blockaded Weyerhaeuser for a month to say, look, this is going too fast. We want to have trees here when our kids are old enough, you know, to log or to walk in the forest. And having a company in Tacoma, Federal Way, Washington, managing this remote forest, having a provincial government down in Victoria, 800 miles away, managing this remote forest, isn't working. And so we have to take charge of it. And I think there's a tremendous model there, that it's the people who have the most to lose, who have the deepest investment in that country, wherever it may be, who have to put their money where their mouth is, and these folks, you know, went without wages. You know, they idled their own saws, they idled their own trucks to say, look, you know, we have to take the long view here. And it's, you know, to have a peaceful interracial collaboration like that is, as far as I know, it's a first in North American history, and it's inspirational.
Well, let's talk with someone else, someone here local in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes. Is this the author John Morton?
My name's John Valiant.
Oh, goody. I was afraid I might be wrong and be Norton, because I'm so furious that we have that Secretary of the Interior, Gail Norton.
Mm.
And
yes, the author is not related to the Secretary of the Interior.
Well, she's just for eliminating bears and
yeah, I
mean, and wolves, and especially wolves, and I've changed my party, but I've talked to our senator in Illinois and our representative in Congress, and I signed petitions to get rid of her.
Yeah, yeah, it's very discouraging, and it kind of harkens back to James Watt, and
yes.
You know, it's a very, you know, it's a common attitude, and it's global, unfortunately.
Oh.
And but you know, people like you and us, you know, we
yeah.
still do, you know, ultimately elect governments, and we have some very hard choices to make, and I think, you know, we need to think in the long term, you know, and I think that thinking in that way, thinking systemically rather than immediately and looking, you know, what's my stock doing right now, you know, what's my portfolio doing, as opposed to, you know, there's this, you know, much greater portfolio, you know, in terms of the planet Earth and you know, North America and the United States, you know, this beautiful, wonderful country that has so much and could keep having so much. I mean, it could sustain us, you know, for centuries to come if we manage it properly.
That's exactly right. And my children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren are such naturalists.
Yeah.
And we've grown up in the Great Lakes area. And however, my husband was a professor of engineering. We've been in Illinois since 1940 at the University of Illinois. And I'm 86. But anyway, we're all such naturalists. I sometimes, every time I pull up a dandelion, I think, well, should I replant it someplace?
Yeah, I mean,
and my son majored in forestry,
mm-hmm.
and he's just aggravated. He won't even. I can't wait to buy your book, because he's leaving to go to Europe to hike up near the Himalayas, and he's done a lot of hiking.
Yeah.
In fact, he rode his bicycle, put the back wheel in.
Well, I'm really glad that you're out there and that you're thinking about these things and that you're passionate about them. And I think you know, you're not alone. You know, there are many millions of us, and I think, you know, the petitions and the votes and the more, you know, I hope that this book will offer something to that, because I really tried to write something that isn't a polemic and full of judgments. It's more like, here's a situation, you know, let's look at it. And I'm hoping it's a book that foresters will read and loggers will read and maybe people who make policy will read it. Because I think it's, you know, it's really trying to find a way to understand ourselves and what we do and why we do it and the history of it. You know, you can't look at it in isolation.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's even helpful to, you know, to pass judgment and make and blame. You know, I think we need to understand the whole system.
And I guess it makes me think about, you were talking about just how successful it was with people in this region talking about how should we manage and preserve our own resource. And they're, after all, the ones that either have the benefits or bear the costs, no matter what. But it does also make you think that there's got to be, if you're going to have some kind of coherent national policy, you've got to convince people, for example, who live in Illinois, that they have some sort of stake in the way that the rainforest of the Pacific Northwest is managed. And I think that that's not easy when you're talking about something that's a long way away that people here maybe have never seen and maybe never will.
That's right. That's right. And I hope that the book will be a way for people to see it, you know, vicariously. And mm-hmm. and but I think that is, you know, I keep coming back to this. I feel like I'm belaboring a little bit, but the importance of looking at things systemically, and that, you know, Illinois is a obviously, you know, the home for millions of people, and people have a deep connection to it, and many people probably don't even travel that far out of it, but it's part of this larger system. And yet, and Illinois, you know, certainly, I don't know what the exact state of its forests are now, but there were once, you know, enormous forests there that were, you know, felled very rapidly in the late 19th century, and, you know, with abandon. You know, a lot of it was burned and essentially squandered as people just kind of mowed their way through across the continent. But a lot of those forests are coming back, too, and the animals and, you know, the entire ecosystem. You know, it is restorable, and you know, that's our challenge, yeah. I think.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there because we've come to the end of the time. If you want to read the story, and it's a good story, I would suggest you look for the book. It's titled The Golden Spruce by our guest, John Valiant, and the book is published by W.W. Norton. John, thanks very much.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.